There is Uriens and Marcus of Cornwall. He too grows old. They shall see that their king is not too proud to come and speak to them today. Stay here by Guinevere, Lance. Let it be like old times today. Lancelot did as he was asked, sitting on the bench beside Guinevere. At last he asked, "Is Arthur ill?" Guinevere shook her head. "I think he has penance to do, and is brooding about it."
"Well, surely Arthur can have no great sin on his soul," Lancelot said.
"He is one of the most spotless men I know. I am proud that he is still my friend. I do not deserve it, I know, Gwen."
He looked at her so sadly that again Guinevere almost wept. Why couldn't she have loved the two of them without sin? Why had God ordained that a woman must have only one husband? She was grown as bad as Morgaine that she could think such a thing. She touched his hand. "Are you happy with Elaine, Lancelot?"
"Happy? What man alive is happy? I do as best I can."
She looked down at her hands. For a moment she forgot that this man had been her lover, and remembered only that he had been her friend. "I want you to be happy. Truly I do." His hand closed for a moment over hers.
"I know, my dear. I didn't want to come here today. I love you, and I love Arthur. But the day is past when I can be content to be his captain of horse, and—"
His voice broke.
"And the champion of the queen."
She said suddenly, looking up, her hand in his, "Does it seem sometimes to you that we are no longer young, Lancelot?"
He nodded and sighed. "Aye, it does so."
Morgaine had taken the harp again and was singing. Lancelot said,
"Her voice is as sweet as ever. I'm put in memory of my mother singing. She sang not so well as Morgaine, but she had the same soft, low voice."
"Morgaine is as young as ever," said Guinevere jealously.
"It is so with those of the old blood. They seem ever young until the day they are suddenly old," Lancelot said.
Then, bending down to touch her cheek in a light kiss, he said abruptly,
"Never think you are less beautiful than Morgaine, my Gwen. It is a different beauty, that is all."
"Why do you say this?"
"Love, I cannot bear it if you are unhappy."
She said, "I do not think I know what it means to be happy." "How is Morgaine so untouched? That which wrecked my life and Arthur's, it lies lightly on her. There she sits laughing and singing, and yonder knight with the serpents about his wrists is glamoured by her." Soon after, Lancelot said he must go back to Elaine, and left her. And when Arthur returned, there were companions and old followers coming to him for concessions, to give him gifts and recall their service. After a time, Uriens of North Wales came, portly now and greying, but he still had all his own teeth, and he led his men into the field when he must.
He said, "I have come to ask you a favour, Arthur. I want to marry again, and I would like to be allied with your house. I have heard that Lot of Lothian is dead, and I ask your permission to marry his widow, Morgause."
Arthur had to stifle a laugh.
"Ah, for that, my friend, you must ask leave of Sir Gawain. Lothian is his now, and no doubt he would be glad to marry his mother away. But no doubt the lady is old enough to have a mind of her own. I cannot order her to marry. It would be like ordering my mother to marry."
Guinevere was struck by sudden inspiration. This would be the perfect solution. Arthur himself had said that if it became known at court, Morgaine could be scorned or shamed. She reached out and touched Arthur's sleeve. She said in a low voice, "Arthur, Uriens is a valuable ally. You have told me that the mines of Wales are valuable as they were to the Romans for iron and lead, and you have a kinswoman whose marriage is in your keeping. He looked at her, startled.
Urien's is so old.
Morcain is older than you, she said, and since he has grown sons and grandsons, he will not mind too much if Morgain doesn't give him children.
That is true, said Arthur with a frown, and this seems a good match.
He raised his head to Urien's and said,
I cannot order Lady Morgawse to marry again, but my sister, the Duchess of Cornwall, isn't married.
Urien's bowed.
I could not presume to ask so high, my king. But if your sister would be queen in my country... I will compel no woman to marry unwilling, said Arthur, but I will ask her.
He beckoned one of the pages.
Ask the Lady Morgain if she will come to me when she has finished singing.
Urien's eyes were on Morgain where she sat, her dark gown lending fairness to her skin.
She is very beautiful, your sister. Any man would think himself fortunate to have such a wife.
As Urien's went to his seat, Arthur said thoughtfully, watching Morgain come toward them,
She is long unmarried. She must wish for a home of her own where she will be mistress, rather than serving another woman always. And she is too learned for many young men. But Urien's will be glad that she is gracious and will rule his home well. I wish, though, that he weren't quite so old.
I think she will be happier with an older man, Guinevere said. She is not a giddy young thing. Morgain came and curtsied to them. Always in public, she was smiling and impassive, and Guinevere was, for once, glad of it.
Sister, said Arthur, I have had an offer of marriage for you. And after this morning,
he lowered his voice,
I think it well you should not live at court for a time.
Indeed, I would be glad to be gone from here, brother.
Why then? Arthur said. How would you like to live in North Wales? I hear it is desolate there, but no more than Tintagel, surely.
To Guinevere's surprise, Morgain blushed like a girl of 15. I will not try to pretend I am as surprised as all that, brother.
Arthur chuckled. Why, he didn't tell me he had spoken to you, the sly fellow.
Morgain coloured and played with the end of her braid. She didn't, Guinevere thought, look anywhere near her age.
You may tell him I should be happy to live in North Wales.
Arthur said gently,
Does the difference in age not bother you?
Her face was rosy. If it doesn't bother him, it doesn't bother me.
So be it, said Arthur,
and beckoned to Urien's, who came beaming.
My sister has told me that she would like it well to be Queen of North Wales, my friend. I see no reason we cannot have the wedding with all speed, perhaps on Sunday.
He raised his cup and called out to the assembled company.
Drink to a wedding, my friends. A wedding between the Lady Morgain of Cornwall, my dear sister, and my good friend King Urien's of North Wales.
For the first time that day it sounded like a proper Pentecost feasting, as the applause, cries of congratulation, acclaim, all stormed up. Morgain stood still as stone. But she agreed to this. She said he had spoken to her, Guinevere thought. And then she remembered the young man who had been flirting with Morgain. Was that not Urien's son, Accolon? Accolon, that was it. But surely she couldn't have expected him to offer for her. Morgain was older than he was. It must have been Accolon. Will she make a scene? Guinevere wondered. And then, with another surge of hatred, Now let Morgain see what it is like to be given in marriage to a man she doesn't love. So, you will be a queen too, my sister, she said, taking Morgaine's hand. "I shall be your bridewoman." But for all her sweet words, Morgaine looked her straight in the eye, and Guinevere knew that she hadn't been deceived.
"So be it. We will at least be rid of one another, and no more pretense of friendship between us."
Morgaine speaks. "For a marriage destined to end as mine did, it began well enough, I suppose. Guinevere gave me a fine wedding, considering how she hated me. I had 6 bride women, and 4 of them were queens. Arthur gave me some fine and costly jewellery. I had never cared a great deal for jewellery, having not been accustomed to wear it in Avalon, and never having learned since, though I had a few pieces that had been Igraine's. Now he gave me many more of our mother's gems, and some that had been plunder of the Saxons. I would have protested, but Guinevere reminded me that Uriens would expect to see his wife finely dressed as befitted a queen, and I shrugged and let her deck me out like a child doll. One piece, an amber necklace, I remembered seeing Igraine wear when I was very young, but never since. Once I had seen it in her jewel chest when I was but small, and she said Gaulois had given it her, and one day it should be mine. But before I was old enough to wear it, I was priestess in Avalon, and had no need of jewels. Now it was mine. So many other things that I protested I would never wear them. The one thing I asked of them, to delay the wedding till I could send for Morgause, who was my only living kinswoman, they would not do. Perhaps they thought I might come to my senses and protest that when I agreed to marry into North Wales, I had Accolon in mind, not the old king. I'm sure Guinevere knew, at least. I wondered what Accolon would think of me. I had all but pledged myself to him, and before that night fell I had been publicly promised to his father. I had no chance to ask. But after all, I suppose Accolon would want a bride of 15, not one of 34. A woman past 30, so women mostly said, must content herself with a man who had been often married and wanted her for her family connections, or for her beauty or possessions, or perhaps as a mother for his children. Well, my family connections could hardly be better. As for the rest, I had jewels enough. But I could hardly imagine myself as a mother to Accolon, and whatever other children the old man might have. Grandmother to his son's children, perhaps. I reminded myself with a start that Vivian's mother had been a grandmother younger than I was now. She had born Vivian at 13, and Vivian's own daughter had been born before Vivian was 14. I spoke but once alone with Uriens in the 3 days which elapsed between Pentecost and our bridal. Perhaps I hoped that he, a Christian king, would refuse when he knew, or perhaps even now he wanted a young wife who could give him children. Nor did I want him to take me under false pretences and reproach me later. And I knew what a great thing these Christians made of an untouched wife. I suppose they had it from the Romans, with their pride of family and worship of virginity. "I am long past 30 years old, Uriens," I said, "and I am no maiden." I knew no gracious or polite way to say such things. He reached forward and touched the small blue crescent between my brows. It was fading now. I could see it in the mirror, which had been one of Guinevere's gifts. Vivian's had faded too when I came to Avalon, but she had used to paint it with blue dye.
"You were priestess of Avalon, one of the maidens of the Lady of the Lake, and you went as a maiden to the god, is it so?"
I assented.
Uriens said,
"Some of my people still do so, and I make no great effort to put it down. The peasants feel that it is all very well for kings and great folk, who can afford to pay priests and the like to pray them out of hell, to follow the way of Christ.
but it would be hard on them if the old ones, who had been worshipped in our hills since time out of mind, should not have their due. Accolon thinks much the same. But now so much power is going into the hands of the priests, it is needful I too must not offend them.
As for me, I care not what god sits on the throne in heaven, or what god is worshipped by my people, so that my kingdom is at peace.
But once I wore the antlers, I swear I will never reproach you, Lady Morgaine.
Oh, Mother Goddess, I thought, this is grotesque. This is madness.
You jest with me.
I might well have made a happy marriage with Accolon, after all. But Accolon was young, and would wish for a young wife. I said to Uriens,
"One more thing you must know. I bore a child to the Horned One."
"I have said I will not reproach you with anything that is past, Lady Morgaine."
"You do not understand.
It went so ill with me when that child was born, that I will certainly never bear another." "A king," I thought, "a king would want a fertile bride, even more than his younger son." He patted my hand. I think he actually meant to comfort me.
"I have sons enough," he said. "I have no need of others. Children are a fine thing, but I have had my share, and more."
I thought, he is foolish, he is old, but he is kind. If he had professed a madness of desire for me, I would have been sickened by him. But kindness I can live with.
"Do you grieve for your son, Morgaine? If you wish, you may send for him and have him fostered at my court. And I swear to you that neither he nor you shall ever hear a word of reproach, and he shall be decently reared as befits the son of the Duchess of Cornwall and the Queen of North Wales."
This kindness brought tears to my eyes.
"You are very kind," I said, "but he is well where he is, in Avalon."
"Well, if you decide otherwise, tell me," he said. "I would be glad of another boy about the house, and he would be the right age, I suppose, for a playmate to my youngest son, Uwain."
"I thought Accolon was your youngest, sir."
"No, no. Uwain is only 9 years old. His mother died when he was born. You wouldn't think an old fellow like me could have a boy as young as 9, would you?"
"Why, yes, I would," I thought with an ironic smile. "Men are as proud of their ability to father sons as if it took a great skill."
"As if any tomcat couldn't do the same.
At least a woman must bear a child in her body for most of a year, and suffer to bring it forth, and so she has some reason for pride. But men accomplish their trick with no thought or trouble at all." But I said, trying to make a jest of it, "When I was a young girl, sir, there was a saying in my country, 'A husband of 40 may not become a father, but a husband of 60 surely will do so.'" I had done this deliberately. If he had gone stiff and offended by the ribaldry of that, I would have known how I must treat him in the future, and taken great care always to speak to him modest and quiet. Instead, he laughed heartily and said, "I think you and I may agree well enough, my dear. I have had enough of being married to young girls who don't know how to laugh. I hope you will be content marrying an old fellow like me. My sons laugh at me because I married again after Uwain was born. But to tell the truth, Lady Morgaine, a man gets used to being married, and I do not like living alone. And when my last wife died of the summer fever, well, it is true that I wished to be akin by marriage to your brother, but also I am lonely. And it comes to me that you, who are unmarried so many years beyond the women of your age, you may not like it so ill to have a home and a husband, even if he is not young and handsome. I know you are not consulted about this marriage, but I hope you will not be too unhappy." At least, I thought, he doesn't expect me to be madly excited about the great honour of being married to him.
I could have said that it would be no change.
I hadn't truly been happy since I left Avalon, and since I would be unhappy wherever I was. At least it would be better to be away from Guinevere's malice. I could no longer make pretense to be her loyal kinswoman and friend, and that saddened me somewhat, because there had been a time when we had truly been friends, and it was not I who had changed. I certainly had no wish to rob her of Lancelot. But how could I explain to her that though I had once desired him, I despised him too, and wouldn't have had him for a husband as a gift? Oh, yes, if Arthur had married us to each other before he was wed to Guinevere. But even then it was too late. It was always too late after that afternoon beneath the ringstones. If I had let him take me then, none of this would have come about. But done is done, and I hadn't known what other plans Vivian had had for me. And they had brought me in the end to this wedding with Urien's. Our first bedding was about what I expected. He stroked me and fussed and pumped away atop me for a little while, snorting and breathing hard, and then was suddenly done and away from me and asleep. Having expected no better, I wasn't disappointed, nor particularly sorry to curl up in the curve of his arm. He liked having me there, and although after the first few weeks he lay with me but seldom, still he liked having me in his bed, and would sometimes hold me in his arms for hours, talking of this and that, and what was more, listening to what I said. Unlike the Romans of the south, these men of the tribes never scorned to listen to a woman's advice, and for that, at least, I was grateful, that he would hear what I said, and never put it aside as being but a woman's counsel. North Wales was a beautiful country, great hills and mountains that reminded me of the country of Lothian. But where Lothian was high and barren, Urien's country was all green and fertile, lush with trees and flowers, and the soil was rich and the crops good. Urien's had built his castle in one of the finer valleys. His son, Avaloch, and Avaloch's wife and children deferred to me in all things, and his youngest son, Uwain, called me mother. I came to know what it might have been to have a son to bring up, to look after all the little daily concerns of a growing child, climbing trees and breaking bones, outgrowing his clothes or tearing them in the woods, being rude to his tutors, or taking dog's leave to go hunting when he should have been at his book. The priest who taught Uwain his letters despaired, but he was the pride and joy of the almsmaster. Troublesome as he was, I loved him well. He waited on me at dinner, and often sat in hall to listen to me when I played the harp. Like all the folk of that country, he had an ear for music and a clear and tuneful voice. And like all of that court, Urien's family would rather make music themselves than listen to paid minstrels. After a year or two, I began to think of Uwain as my own son, and of course he couldn't remember his own mother. Wild as he was always gentle with me. Boys that age aren't easy to control, but there were endearing moments. After days of rudeness or sullenness, when he would suddenly come and sit by me in the hall and sing to my harp, or bring me wild flowers or a clumsily tanned hareskin. And once or twice, awkward and shy as a young stork, he would bend and brush my cheek with his mouth. Often I wished then that I had had children of my own that I could rear myself. There was little enough else to do at this quiet court, far away from the wars and troubles to the south. And then, when I had been married to Urien's for a year, Accolon came home. Chapter 9. Summer on the hills, the orchard in the Queen's garden covered with pink and white blossoms. Morgaine, walking beneath the trees, felt an aching homesickness all through her blood, remembering the Avalon spring and the trees covered with those white and rosy clouds. The year was swinging toward the summer solstice. Morgaine reckoned it up, realizing ruefully that at last the effects of half a lifetime in Avalon were wearing away. The tides no longer ran in her blood. No, need I lie to myself? It isn't that I have forgotten, or that the tides no longer run in my blood. It is that I no longer let myself feel them. Morgaine considered herself dispassionately, the sombre, costly gown, suitable for a queen. Uriens had given her all the gowns and jewels which had belonged to his late wife, and she had her jewels from Igraine as well. Uriens liked to see her decked out in jewels befitting a queen. Some kings kill their prisoners of state, or enslave them in their mines. If it pleases the King of North Wales to hang his with jewels and parade her forth at his side and call her queen, why not? Yet she felt full of the flow of the summer. Beneath her on the hillside she could hear a ploughman encouraging his ox with soft cries. Tomorrow would be midsummer. Next Sunday a priest would carry torches into the field and circle it in procession with his acolytes, chanting psalms and blessings. The richer barons and knights, who were all Christian, had persuaded the people that this was more seemly in a Christian country than the old ways, where the people lighted fires in the fields and called the lady in the old worship. Morgaine wished, and not for the first time, that she had been only one of the priestesses, not one of the great royal line of Avalon. I would still be there, she thought, one of them, doing the work of the lady, not here, like any shipwrecked sailor lost in an alien land. Abruptly she turned and walked through the blossoming garden, her eyes downcast, refusing to look any further at the apple blossoms. Spring comes again and again, and the summer follows with its fruitfulness. But I am as alone and barren as one of those locked-up Christian virgins within convent walls. She set her will against the tears which seemed somehow always beneath the surface these days, and went inside. Behind her, the setting sun spread crimson over the fields, but she wouldn't look at it. All was grey and barren here, as grey and barren as I. One of her women greeted her as she stepped inside the door. "My lady, the king has returned and would see you in his chamber." "Yes, I suppose so," said Morgaine, more to herself than to the woman. A tight band of headache settled around her forehead, and for a moment she couldn't breathe, couldn't force herself to walk inside the darkness of the castle, which, all this cold winter, had closed round her like a trap. Then she told herself not to be fanciful, set her teeth, and went to Urien's chamber, where she found him half-clad and lying on the flagstones, stretched out with his body-servant rubbing his back. "You have tired yourself again," she said, not adding, "You are no longer young enough to go about your own lands like this." He had ridden to a nearby town to hear about some disputed lands. She knew that he would want her to sit beside him and listen to his tales of all that he had heard in the countryside. She sat down in her own chair nearby and listened with half an ear to what he told her.
"You can go, Berek," he told the man. "My lady will fetch my clothes for me."
When the man had gone, he asked,
"Morgaine, will you rub my feet? Your hands are better than his."
"Certainly, but you'll have to sit in the chair." He stretched out his hands, and she gave him a tug upward. She placed a footstool under his feet and knelt beside it, chafing his thin, calloused old feet until the blood rose to the surface and they looked alive again. Then she fetched a flask and began to rub one of her herbal oils into the king's gnarled toes. "You should have your man make you some new boots," she said. "The crack in the old ones will make a sore there. See where it is blistered?"
"But the old ones fit me so well, and boots are so stiff when they are new,"
he protested.
Morgain said, "You must do as you like, my lord."
"No, no, you are right as always," he said. "I will tell the man tomorrow to come and measure my feet for a pair."
Morgain, putting away her flask of herbal oil and fetching a pair of shapeless old soft shoes, thought, "I wonder if he knows that this may be his last pair of boots, and that is why he is reluctant." She wouldn't think about what the king's death would mean to her. She didn't want to wish him dead. He had never been anything but kind to her. She slid the soft indoor slippers on his feet and stood up, wiping her hands on a towel. "Is that better, my lord?"
"Wonderful, my dear, thank you. No one can look after me the way you do," he said.
Morgain sighed.
When he had the new boots, he would have more trouble with his feet. They would, as he had rightly foreseen, be stiff, and that would make his feet just as sore as they were now.
Perhaps he should stop riding and stay at home in his chair, but he wouldn't do that. She said, "You should have Avaloch ride out to hear these cases. He must learn to rule over his people." His oldest son was the same age as she. He had waited long enough to rule, and Urien's looked like living forever.
"True, true. But if I do not go, they will think their king doesn't care for them," Urien said. "But perhaps when the roads are bad next winter, I will do so."
"You had better," she said. "If you have chilblains again, you could lose the use of your hands."
"The fact is, Morgain," he said,
smiling his good-natured smile at her,
"I am an old man, and there is nothing that can be done about it. Do you think there is roast pork for supper?"
"Yes," she said, "and some early cherries. I made sure of that."
"You are a notable housekeeper, my dear," he said,
and took her arm as they went out of the room. She thought, "He thinks he's being kind to say so." The household of Urien's was assembled already for the evening meal. Avaloch, Avaloch's wife Melin, and their young children. Uwain, lanky and dark, with his three young foster brothers, and the priest who was their tutor. And below them, at the long table, the men-at-arms and their ladies, and the upper servants. As Urien's and Morgain took their seats, and Morgain signalled to the servants to bring food, Melin's younger child began to clamour and shout.
"Granny, I want to sit on Granny's knee. I want Granny to feed me."
Melin, a slender, fair-haired, pale young woman, heavily pregnant, frowned and said,
"No, Con, sit down prettily and be quiet."
But the child had already toddled to Morgain's knee, and she laughed and lifted him up. "I'm an unlikely grandmother," she thought. "Melin is almost as old as I." But Urien's grandsons were fond of her, and she hugged the little boy close, taking pleasure in the feel of the small, curly head digging into her waist, the grubby little fingers clutching at her. She sliced bits of pork with her knife and fed them to Con from her own plate, then cut him a piece of bread in the shape of a pig.
"See,
now you have more pork to eat," she said, wiping her greasy fingers, and turned her attention to her own meal.
She ate but little meat, even now. She soaked her bread in the meat juices, but no more. She was quickly finished while the rest were still eating. She leaned back in her chair and began to sing softly to Con, who curled up contentedly in her lap. After a time, she grew aware that they were all listening to her, and she let her voice drop away.
"Please go on singing, Mother,"
Uwain said, but she shook her head.
"No,
I'm tired.
Listen, what did I hear in the courtyard?" She rose and signalled to one of the serving men to light her to the doorway. Torch held high, he stood behind her, and she saw the rider come into the great courtyard. The serving man stuck his torch into one of the wall brackets and hurried to help the rider dismount.
"Mayor Acolon."
He came, his scarlet cape swirling behind him like a river of blood.
"Lady Morgain,"
he said, with a deep bow.
Or should I say, my lady mother?
Please do not, Morgaine said impatiently. Come in, Accolon. Your father and brothers will be happy to see you.
As you are not, lady.
She bit her lip suddenly, wondering if she would weep. She said, You are a king's son, as I am a king's daughter. Do I have to remind you how such marriages are made? It was not my doing, Accolon. And when we spoke together, I had no idea... She stopped, and he looked down at her, then stooped over her hand. He said so softly that even the serving man didn't hear.
Poor Morgaine.
I believe you, lady.
Peace between us, then, mother.
Only if you do not call me mother, she said, with a shred of a smile. I am not so old. It is well enough for Uwain. And then, as they came back into the hall, Conn started upright and began to cry out again for Granny. Morgaine laughed mirthlessly and went back to pick up the toddler. She was aware of Accolon's eyes on her. She cast her own down at the child in her lap, listening silently as Uriens greeted his son. Accolon came formally to embrace his brother, to bow before his brother's wife. He knelt and kissed his father's hand, and then turned to Morgaine. She said shortly, Spare me further courtesies, Accolon. My hands are all pork-fat. I've been holding the baby, and he is a messy feeder.
As you command, madam, said Accolon,
going to the table and taking the plate one of the serving women brought to him. But while he ate and drank, she was still conscious of his eyes.
I'm sure he's still angry with me, asking my hand in the morning, and in the evening seeing me promise to his father. No doubt he thinks I succumbed to ambition. Why marry the king's son if you can have the king?
No, she said firmly, giving Conn a little shake. If you are to stay in my lap, you must be quiet, and not paw at my dress with your greasy hands. When he saw me last, I was clad in scarlet, and I was the king's sister, reputed a witch. Now I am a grandmother with a dirty child in my lap, looking after the housekeeping, and nagging my old husband not to ride in mended boots which make his feet sore. Morgaine was acutely aware of every grey hair, every line in her face. In the name of the goddess, why should I care what Accolon thinks of me? But she did care, and she knew it. She was accustomed to having young men look at her and admire her, and now she felt that she was old, ugly, undesirable. She had never thought herself a beauty, but always before this she had been one of the younger people. And now she sat among the aging matrons. She shushed the child again, for Maeline had asked Accolon what news of Arthur's court.
There's no news of great doings, Accolon said. I think those days are over for our lifetime. Arthur's court is quiet, and the king still does penance for some unknown sin. He touches no wine, even at high feast days.
Has the queen yet shown any signs of bearing him an heir?
Maeline asked.
None, said Accolon.
Though one of her ladies told me before the mock games that she thought the queen might be pregnant. Maeline turned to Morgaine and said,
You knew the queen well, did you not, mother-in-law?
I did, said Morgaine. And as for that rumour, well, Guinevere always thinks herself pregnant if her courses come a day late.
The king is a fool, said Uriens. He should put her away and take some woman who would give him a son. I remember all too well what chaos ruled the land when they thought Uther would die with no son. Now the succession should be firmly established.
Accolon said, I have heard that the king has named one of his cousins for his heir, the son of Lancelot.
I like that not. Lancelot is the son of Ban of Benwick, and we want no foreign high kings reigning over our own.
Morgaine said firmly, Lancelot is the son of the Lady of Avalon, of the old royal line.
Avalon, said Maeline disdainfully. This is a Christian land. What is Avalon to us now?
More than you think, said Accolon. I have heard that some of the country people who remember the Pendragon are not happy with so Christian a court as Arthur's, and remember that Arthur, before his crowning, took oath to stand with the folk of Avalon.
Yes, said Morgaine,
and he bears the great sword of the holy regalia of Avalon.
The Christians seem not to hold that against him, Accolon said.
And now I remember some news from the court. King Edric of the Saxons has turned Christian and come to be baptized with all his retinue at Glastonbury. And he knelt and took oath before Arthur, in token that all the Saxon lands accepted Arthur as High King.
Arthur, king over Saxons, will wonders never cease,
Avaloch said.
I have always heard him say he would deal with the Saxons only at the point of his sword.
Yet there he was, the Saxon king, kneeling in Glastonbury Church, and Arthur, hearing his oath and taking him by the hand, said Accolon.
Perhaps he will marry the Saxon's daughter to the son of Lancelot, and have done with all this fighting. And there sat Merlin among Arthur's counsellors, and one would have said he was as good a Christian as any of them.
Guinevere must be happy now, said Morgaine.
Always, she said, God had given Arthur the victory at Mount Baden, because he bore the banner of the Holy Virgin. And later I heard her say that God had spared his life that he might bring the Saxons into the fold of the church.
Urien shrugged and said, I do not think I would trust a Saxon behind me with an axe, even if he wore a bishop's mitre.
Nor I, said Avaloch. But if the Saxon chiefs are praying and doing penance for their souls' sake, at least they are not riding to burn our villages and abbeys. And as to penance and fasting, what think you can Arthur have on his conscience? When I rode with his armies, I was not among his companions, and knew him not so well. But he seemed an uncommon good man, and a penance of such length means some sin greater than common. Lady Morgaine, do you know, you who are his sister?
His sister, not his confessor.
Morgaine knew her voice was sharp, and fell silent.
Urien said,
Any man who waged war for 15 years among the Saxons must have more on his conscience than he cares to tell. But few are so tender of conscience as to think of it when the battle is past. All of us have known murder and ravage and blood and the slaughter of the innocent. But the battles are over for our lifetime, God grant, and having made our peace with men, we have leisure to make peace with God.
So Arthur does penance still, and that old Archbishop Patricia still holds the mortgage on his soul.
How, I wonder, does Guinevere enjoy that?
Tell us more of the court, Maeline begged. What of the Queen? What did she wear when she sat at court?
Accolon laughed.
I know nothing of ladies' garments.
Something of white, with pearls. The Marhaus, the great Irish knight, brought them to her from the Irish king. And her cousin Elaine, I heard, has borne Lancelot a daughter.
Or was that last year?
She had a son already, I think, that was chosen Arthur's heir. And there is some scandal in King Pellinore's court. It seems that his son, Lamorak, went on a mission to Lothian, and now speaks of marrying Lot's widow, old Queen Morgause.
Avaloch chuckled.
The boy must be mad. Morgause is 50, at least, maybe more.
45, Morgaine said. She is 10 years older than I. And she wondered why she thus turned the knife in her own wound.
Do I want Accolon to realize how old I am, grandmother to Urien's brood?
He is mad indeed, Accolon said, singing ballads and carrying about the lady's garter and such nonsense. I should think that same garter would make a horse's halter by now, said Urien's.
And Accolon shook his head.
No. I have seen Lot's lady, and she is a beautiful woman still. She isn't a girl, but she seems all the more beautiful for that. What I wonder is, what can the woman want with a raw boy like that? Lamorack is not more than 20. Or what can a boy like that want with the old lady?
Avaloch insisted.
Perhaps, said Uriens, with a ribald laugh, the lady is well learned at sport among the cushions. Though one would hardly think she could have learned it, married all those years to old Lot, but no doubt she had other teachers.
Maylene flushed and said, Please, is this talk seemly in a Christian household?
Urien said,
If it were not, daughter-in-law, I doubt your girdle would be grown so wide.
I'm a married woman, said Maylene crimson.
Morgaine said sharply, If to be a Christian household means not to speak of what one is not ashamed to do, then the lady forbid I should ever call myself Christian.
Still, said Avaloch, perhaps it is ill done to sit here at meat and tell ugly stories about Lady Morgaine's kinswoman.
Accolon said, Queen Morgause has no husband to be offended, and the lady is of age, and her own mistress. No doubt her sons are well pleased that she contents herself with a paramour, and doesn't marry the boy. Is she not also the Duchess of Cornwall?
No, said Morgaine.
Igraine was Duchess of Cornwall after Gawlois was set down for his treason to Pendragon. Gawlois had no son, and since Uther gave Tintagel to Igraine for bride gift, I suppose now it belongs to me. And Morgaine was suddenly overcome with homesickness for that half-remembered country, the bleak outline of castle and crags against the sky, the sudden dips into hidden valleys, the eternal noise of the sea below the castle.
Tintagel, my home.
I cannot return to Avalon, but I am not homeless. Cornwall is mine.
And under the Roman law, said Uriens, I suppose, as your husband, my dear, I am Duke of Cornwall.
Again Morgaine felt the surge of violent anger. Only when I am dead and buried, she thought,
Uriens cares nothing for Cornwall, only that Tintagel, like myself, is his property, bearing the mark of his ownership. Would that I could go there, live there alone as Morgawes at Lothian, my own mistress with none to command me. A picture came in her mind, the Queen's chamber at Tintagel, and she seemed very small. She was playing with an old spindle on the floor.
If Uriens dares to lay claim to an acre of Cornwall, I will give him 6 feet of it, and dirt between his teeth. Tell me now your news of this country, said Accolon. The spring was late. I see the ploughmen are just getting into the fields.
But they have nearly done with ploughing, said Maylene, and Sunday they will go to bless the fields. And they are choosing the spring maiden, said Owain. I was down in the village, and I saw them choosing among all the pretty girls. You were not here last year, mother, he said to Morgaine. They choose the prettiest of all for the spring maiden, and she walks in the procession around the fields when the priests come to bless it. And there are dancers who dance round the fields, and they carry an image made from the last harvest, made from the barley straw. Father Ian doesn't like that, he said. But I don't know why not. It is so pretty.
The priest coughed and said self-consciously,
The blessing of the church should be enough. Why should we need more than the word of God to make the fields grow and blossom? The straw image they carry is a memory of the bad old days when men and animals were burned alive so that their lives should make the fields fertile, and the spring maiden a memory of... Well... I will not speak before children of that evil and idolatrous custom.
There was a day, said Accolon, speaking directly to Morgaine, when the queen of the land was the spring maiden and the harvest lady as well, and she did that office in the fields, that the fields might have life and fertility. Morgain saw at his wrists the faint blue shadow of the serpents of Avalon. Maylene made the sign of the cross and said primly,
God be thanked that we live among civilized men.
Accolon said,
I doubt you would be asked to do that office, sister-in-law.
No,
said Uwain, tactless as any boy.
She's not pretty enough. But our mother is, isn't she, Accolon?
I'm glad you think my queen is handsome, said Uriens hastily. But the past is past. We do not burn cats and sheep alive in the fields, nor kill the king's scapegoat to scatter his blood there, and it is no longer needful that the queen should bless the fields in that way.
No, thought Morgaine. Now all is sterile. Now we have priests with their crosses forbidding the lighting of the fires of fertility. It is a miracle that the lady doesn't blight the fields of grain, since she is angry at being denied her due. Soon after, the household went to rest. Morgaine, the last to rise from her seat, went to supervise the locks and bars, and then, with a small lamp in her hand, to make sure Accolon had been given a good bed. Uwain and his foster brothers were now occupying the room that had been his when he lived here as a boy.
Is all well with you here?
Everything I could desire, said Accolon, except a lady to grace my chamber. My father is a fortunate man, lady, and you well deserve to be the wife of a king, not of a king's younger son.
Must you always taunt me? She burst out. I have told you I was given no choice.
You were pledged to me.
Morgaine knew that the colour was leaving her face. She set her lips like stone.
Done is done, Accolon.
She lifted her lamp and turned away. He said behind her, almost a threat,
This is not done between us, lady.
Morgaine didn't speak. She hurried along the corridor to the chamber she shared with Uriens. Her lady-in-waiting was ready to unlace her gown, but she sent the woman away. Uriens sat on the edge of the bed, groaning.
Even those slippers are too hard on my feet. Ah, it is good to go to rest.
Rest well, then, my lord.
No,
he said, and pulled her down at his side.
So tomorrow the fields are to be blessed. Perhaps we should be grateful we live in a civilized land, and the king and the queen need no longer bless the fields by lying together in public. But on the eve of the blessing, dear lady, perhaps we should have our own blessing, private, in our chamber. What would you say to that?
Morgaine sighed. She had been scrupulously careful of her aging husband's pride. Never did she make him feel less than a man for his occasional and clumsy use of her body. But Accolon had roused in her an anguished memory of her years in Avalon. The torches borne to the top of the tor, the Beltane fires lighted, and the maidens waiting in the ploughed fields. And tonight she had had to hear a shabby priest mocking what was to her holy beyond holiness. Now even Uriens, it seemed, made a mockery of it. I would say that such blessing as you and I might give the fields would be better left undone. I am old and barren, and you are not such a king as could give much life to the fields either.
Uriens stared at her. In all the year of their marriage, she had never spoken a harsh word to him.
He was too startled even to reproach her.
I doubt it not, you are right, he said quietly. Well then, we will leave that to the young people. Come to bed, Morgaine.
But when she lay down beside him, he lay quiet, and after a moment he put a shy arm across her shoulders. Now Morgaine was regretting her harsh words. She felt cold and alone. She lay biting her lips so that she wouldn't cry. But when Urien spoke to her, she pretended she was asleep. Midsummer dawned brilliant and beautiful. Morgaine, waking early, realized that however much she might say to herself that the sun tides ran no longer in her blood, there was something within her that ran heavy with the summer. As she dressed, she looked dispassionately at the sleeping form of her husband. She had been a fool. Why should she have accepted compliantly Arthur's word, fearing to embarrass him before his fellow kings? If he couldn't keep his throne without a woman's help, it might be he didn't deserve to hold it. He was a traitor to Avalon, an apostate. He had given her into the hands of another apostate. Yet she had meekly agreed to what they had planned for her. Igraine let her life be used for their politics. And something in Morgaine, dead or sleeping since the day she fled forth from Avalon, bearing Gwydion within her womb, suddenly woke and stirred, moving sluggishly and slow like a sleeping dragon, a movement as secret and unseen as the first movements of a child in the womb. Something that said, clear and quiet within her, "If I would not let Vivian, whom I loved, use me this way, why should I bow my head meekly and let myself be used for Arthur's purposes? I am queen in North Wales, and I am duchess in Cornwall, where Gauloise's name still means something, and I am of the royal line of Avalon." Uriens groaned, heaving himself stiffly over.
"Oh, God, I ache in every muscle. There is a toothache in every toe of my foot. I rode too far yesterday. Morgaine, will you rub my back?"
She started to fling back furiously. "You have a dozen body servants, and I am your wife, not your slave." Then stopped herself. Instead, she smiled and said, "Yes, of course," and sent a page boy for her vials of herbal oil. Let him think her still compliant to everything. Healing was a part of a priestess's work. If it was the smallest part, still it gave her access to his plans and his thoughts. She rubbed his back and kneaded salve into his sore feet, listening to the small details of the land dispute he had ridden out yesterday to settle. For Uriens, any woman could be queen. He wants only a smiling face and kind hands to cosset him. Well, he shall have them while it suits my purpose.
"And now it looks as if we would have a fine day for the blessing of the crops. We never have rain at Midsummer Day,"
Urien said.
"The lady shines on her fields when they are consecrated to her. That is what they used to say when I was young and a pagan, that the great marriage could not be consummated in the rain."
He chuckled.
"Still, I remember once, when I was very young, when the fields had been rained on for 10 days, and the priestess and I might have been pigs wallowing in the mud."
Against her will, Morgaine smiled. The picture he made in her mind was ludicrous. "Even in ritual the goddess will have her joke," she said. "And one of her names is the Great Sow, and we are all her piglets."
"Ah, Morgaine, those were good times," he said.
Then his face tightened.
"Of course, that was long ago. Now what the folk want in their kings is dignity. Those days are gone, and forever."
"Are they? I wonder." But Morgaine said nothing. It occurred to her that Uriens, when he was younger, might have been a king strong enough to resist the tide of Christianity washing over the land. If Vivian had tried harder to put a king on the throne who wasn't bound hard and fast to the rule of the priests. But of course, who could have foreseen that Guinevere would be pious beyond all reason? And why had the Merlin done nothing? If the Merlin of Britain and the wise folk at Avalon had done nothing to stem this tide that was drowning the land and washing away all the old ways and the old gods, why should she blame Uriens, who was, after all, only an old man and wanted peace? There was no reason to make him an enemy. If he was content, It wouldn't matter to him what she did. She didn't know yet what she meant to do, but she knew that her days of silent compliance were over. She said, "I wish I had known you then.